It works in a way that ensures communication, things like repetition. We will repeat an idea four or five different ways, four or five different times when we speak to someone else without any hesitation until we see that glimmer of recognition that they have understood. And best of all, it has no spelling and no punctuation. Then we have, of course, written language. Now, written language is only 5,000 years old. We would not dream of repeating an idea four or five times in four or five different ways. Most of us, we were taught in the third grade not to do that. And so we lay it out there once, hope everybody grabbed it the first time around, because that's the only shot you get at it. And worst of all, it has spelling and punctuation. The third language is arithmetic language. Everybody's favorite, of course. As a matter of fact, the National Science Foundation, in a study 3 years ago, concluded that over 66% of all Americans absolutely positively loathe statistics. They positively loathe them, and even bar charts, bar graphs, are not very popular with most. Because you have to look at the chart, and usually you have to go like this to read the damn thing anyway, because it's standing up like that. Then you have to read and follow the red down to find out that it's 16%. So you're right back to statistics after all. It was just a sneaky way of getting me to look at statistics, and I don't like it, okay? In our practice, more and more, even for very sophisticated audiences, we talk about two apples and four oranges. Everybody understands that. You don't have to think about it. Two dogs and four cats, whatever your symbols are. But it is a language. And increasingly in our society, with computerization, digitization, it's a language we need to remember is a language, and it has its own rules, its own functions, and its own proper places to use. The fourth language is visual or graphic language. I've already proven the power of that by just writing the little Chevrolet symbol, and you all knew what it was. Harley Wagner in our firm does a sort of a semi-credible annual study on the importance of non-spoken communication. And his study always finds that a little over half of all the communications that each of us have every day have no words. And it starts right there. There isn't a word on that thing, not a one. It's all symbolic, and yet we see it all the time. Colors, shapes, symbols, all of those methods. And of course, if you've traveled at all, you know that if you see a sign that looks like that, I hope it's not in blue, but if you see a sign that looks like that, only it doesn't have that thing I didn't draw right, well, anyway, whether it says eret in there or whether it says stop, you know it's a stop sign wherever you are in the world. Then there's a fifth language. And we call it Chinese. It isn't Chinese, of course, but it's based on an old Confucian proverb. When in China speak Chinese, it's the only language they understand. And what it means, obviously, is that every branch, probably, of yours has a little different milieu of language. Of course, it isn't every state that has the valley to worry about, but there are different languages in this world. And when I go down south to talk, I have a routine that my colleagues have helped me to learn. And all the way down on the plane, I practice talking more slowly. Because if I go down there and talk in my typical Yankee way, it's all over after about 2 minutes. I am a fast-talking, high-voiced Yankee from up there, and not very trustworthy. But if I can kind of get it down to slow, and really bring it right down to their level, then I can be understood and heard better. That may seem unimportant, but in fact it's totally important. I could fly all the way down there and have wasted my time because I was not aware of Chinese. Now think for just a minute. Think for just a minute about these languages. As practitioners, do we think about these languages? Or as soon as we have something to communicate, do we head for the typewriter and go for written language? If I was to follow each of you back home, I know what the answer to that would be because the evidence is just overwhelming. We, I think, are written language oriented. And the evidence is overwhelming that that is the first most powerful language, because it's person to person, it's human, and that is the second most powerful language. Written language is third most powerful. There are two languages that are better than written. So, can we remember that? Now, if that seems like over-specialization to you, think about other fields. Take a simple field like a carpenter. Does a carpenter have one hammer and one saw? Have you ever seen a carpenter's toolkit? They have a whole battery of saws, a different saw for a different use. And they have four or five different types of hammers. And they use them all in the course of building something. And it seems to me that here again is a way that we can really improve our practice and our effectiveness. We can work toward desired behaviors of people if we will just know what our toolkit is and stop to think about it. You can carry it a step further. What do you use the language for? There are four modes of language. There's language to inform people. There's language to question. And we all know that the difference in how we use the language for those two is great. If we're questioning something, maybe questioning an opposing point of view, maybe just trying to get people to look at their assumptions and question them, if we're doing those things, it's far different than when we're informing. We use different words, different syntax. Then we use language to persuade people. And when we persuade people, we really go all out. We're willing to stretch a point here and there. We may purposely stretch a point and move into hyperbole. We do all kinds of things. And the only other method, the only other mode of language is language to calm. Now, you should become very good at that fourth one. It's a real useful skill, being able to calm people down. And it is a totally different language. The verbs become soft. It's okay to use passive voice. I think it's okay to use passive voice anyway. This business of always being active voice, sometimes it takes 10 words in the active voice to say what you could have said in two in the passive, but that's another subject. We test that last one in large institutions in ways like this. Most of you, and I assume you too, the world being what it is today with terrorists and all, have some kind of an emergency plan, and once or twice a year you probably have a fire drill to do the emergency plan and see if it works. For most of our clients, we try to get the emergency plan on the front or the inside front cover of the internal telephone book, because that's the one tool we find most people have right at their hand. And so the buzzer goes off, and you open it up to here, and you find out where your station is, you know, and who's now in charge of the whole deal now that the world is blowing up and so forth. But there's a glitch always in this, and that is that it's usually the switchboard operator that has to announce this plan. You know, that there's an emergency. And here's what we find. There's an emergency. Head for the exit. Everything's okay. Don't worry about it. But head for the exit. Well, what that says to most people is, God, dive out the window. Clearly, the place is going off in about 30 seconds because of that use of language. And so then we have to train these people to say, this is an emergency. Don't be alarmed. Get your telephone book if you don't know your station. It's on the inside front cover, because people forget those things and panic. And go to your station, walk briskly, but you know the whole routine. But just think of the difference. It's an illustration of the difference. Well, all right, so we know there are some tools in the kit. We know there are some uses to which it can be put. How now do we make that language persuasive, given those methods of persuasion that we have available to us? Well, there are a lot of methods of using language effectively. Aristotle, a guy you may have heard of, had a system. His system may surprise you a little bit. Of course, it was in Greek. It's the only language he spoke. Now, if I can just, oh yes. The first step, he said, was ethos, from which we get our word ethic, by which he meant, first, you have to establish who you are and that you are trustworthy. That's the first step. If you don't do that, nothing else will happen. See the problems for public relations practitioners and organizations that may be being questioned? Because right here, all those wonderful communications we're going to send out and change everybody's mind are in trouble right off because we have some problems with our ethos. If you can do that, says Aristotle, then you can move the logos, Greek for the words. You can then tell them what it is you wanted to tell them. But, he said, you will never persuade them about the logos unless you build in the pathos, the pathos, the emotion. His exact word is, unless you move the conversation to some kind of a high emotional level. Because, he said, people don't give a damn about facts and reality. What they care about is what's going on right in here. Now remember, he was writing a few years ago, so this is not a lot of new ideas. Some of us trying to put together a number of these systems phrase it a little bit differently. See what you think of this one. You're all users of language and communication and persuasion. The first rule, says Eddie Bernays, is don't stiffen the resistance. Don't stiffen the resistance. Now, there's two things wrong with that, aren't there? It begins with a negative, which you're never supposed to do. But sometimes you have to. You see, rules are nice, but they're only frameworks. Only frameworks. And the other thing is that it assumes there is always resistance. Now, that's a point that I love to discuss with my fellow practitioners, because I'm amazed at how many of us forget that most people were born in Missouri, that they really have to be shown, and that they are skeptical as hell about everything. But if you have any doubts, consider a little thing I used to do to my graduate students at BU when I was teaching there in the evenings when my travel schedule allowed. To prove this point, I used to send them out on the same avenue where I sent them out to do those phony studies I talked about yesterday, and they would draw straws, and the poor victim would be given a handful of crisp new $5 bills. And the job of this person was to give those away to people on the street. Now, you're giving away money. I mean, obviously, everybody would want that, right? So you're walking down the street, and this person goes, wait a minute. You know, what's wrong with this kook here? You get the straitjacket. Because it's just so totally out of sync with what people do with money. There is always resistance even to that. Or you may be familiar with the historians who talk about Pearl Harbor, and they have a theory that indeed Roosevelt and the American brass knew that the attack was coming and that they let it happen because on December 6th, 1941, studies showed that almost 34% of Americans were opposed to getting involved in the war regardless. Atrocities in the Far East, concentration camps in Europe had not moved them a bit, 34%. And they knew you cannot fight a war with 34% of the people not involved, as we found out later in Vietnam. On December 8th, 1941, 2% of Americans were opposed to involvement in the war. I think it makes the point, these historians, by the way, may be totally out to lunch. No one will ever know. But it is a theory which I think proves the point. First of all, we don't stiffen the resistance. Secondly, always ask for a willing suspension of disbelief. A willing suspension of disbelief. What we're asking people for is just hear me out. Never mind all those negatives that are in your mind. Just kind of wash those out and hear what I have to say, because it may be important. It may be useful to you. Now, there are a lot of ways to do this. Humor is one way that we ask people to suspend their disbeliefs, because we say something funny to them and then they're kind of willing to accept us in a different way. That's one way. Another way is something that each of us does every day, but you may just never have thought of it as this. We come home at night and something unusual happened that day, and so what do we say to the people around the dinner table? We say, you won't believe this, but, and all we're saying is suspend your disbeliefs. Now, this has some interesting ramifications in working with people. For example, the psychologists tell us that if I'm coming to you person to person, and I sit down and I start right into the communication, right into what I wanted to say to you, that I will not communicate with you. Because the psychologists point out that what they call expression has to come before communication in these personal meetings. In short, small talk. All that foolish small talk that we all profess to hate is in fact absolutely essential to human relationships. It's dog sniffing. That's exactly what it is. We are still animals. Dogs sniff one another to make sure it's safe. Is that other dog going to bite? We do the same thing. What kind of mood is that other dog in? What's going to happen here? So we talk about the weather and where we went last weekend and our families or the boss or whatever. I'm terrible at small talk. Fortunately, I have a staff that gives me a little 3x5 card with four current small talk items on it, and I literally carry this thing around because I'm just awful at it. I hate it. I want to get right to it. It just doesn't work. We've got to ask people for a willing suspension of disbelief. And notice how a lot of this is very much what he was saying about establishing our ethic. Once we've done whatever it is we have to do to set the stage, but notice again, it takes some conscious energy to set that stage. We don't just shoot our message out there. Once we have set the stage, there is then only one rule for effective communication. And that rule is the good old Whiffen rule. Whoops, whiff it. I'm not spelling it too well here today. What's in it for them? It's the only rule, the benefit statement. What is in it for you, for them, for whomever we're addressing? There probably, someone estimated not long ago, there are about 50,000 studies of effective communication that have been done that we have records of. Without exception, they tell us that what's in it for them is a rule. Now, I'd like you to do something when you get back to your office. I would like you to take maybe your last few days' communications, letters, memos, news releases, brochures, speeches, whatever you do. And I'd like you to just glance over them, and I'd like you to discover whether your absolute theme in them was telling the audience, the recipient, the public, what's in it for them. You're going to be disappointed. I know you're going to be disappointed because I have never done this when it didn't come out that we don't tell what's in it for them. The National Editorial Association was concerned about this about 5 years ago, and so they got a bunch of graduate students to do a summer project. And what the summer project was to go to 10 government agencies and 25 large media outlets and to look at all the incoming mail from organizations. And what they found was that 90% of the communications in any form that came there told what was in it for the sender, and only 10% told what was in it for the public. I know you're not that bad, but it's certainly something to think about. Well, I see you're getting restless. That's probably because break time is approaching. And I'm aware of those problems. Shall we take a break now and then wrap it up? Because afterwards, I got some work I want you to do. Right, why don't we take about, this is still a low budget, no coffee, no nothing break. Sorry about that. Keeping audiences interested. It's an interesting study. In fact, the classic one was done at San Diego State University about 5 years ago when Pete Wilson was mayor down there. He sponsored this in the School of Communication, and they found that for the first 10 minutes, almost any speaker can keep any audience interested. Just simple politeness really forces us to pay attention. In the second 10 minutes, people kind of start to be here a little bit and then away a little bit. And they found that after 20 minutes, everybody is into sexual fantasizing. Now, the reason I share this research with you is so that if your neighbor starts to nod off, you'll know what's going on, and you can give them a little nudge and get them back here to the subject. We talked about going back to very, very basics. We talked about our toolkit of languages, the forms that we can use those languages for. We talked about methods of using them persuasively. I just want to wrap that piece up, however, because all of this is leading somewhere. A what's in it for them message essentially is an enlightened self-interest message, if it's going to be of any value to you as a representative of the bank. And if you'll think a minute about enlightened self-interest is nothing more than symmetrical public relations. What's in our best interest is in your best interest, and so we are cooperating to achieve these desired behaviors. Now comes one of the hard parts for public relations professionals. Sometimes the institution, its policies, its products, or whatever, are simply not symmetrical. Is our role then to say, well, you know, I'm just here to communicate or do whatever I'm supposed to do? Or do you sense, do you feel a responsibility to point out the fact that this is not symmetrical public relations? We are not in an enlightened self-interest situation, so that you, in essence, are asking me as a professional to try and persuade people to an asymmetrical circumstance. In short, you're trying to ask me to manipulate the audience if that's possible. I'm not sure we're going to spend much time on this, but I want you to think about that. And the reason I want you to think about it is this, that I have found in my agglomeration of experience of my own and all of the other people that I interact with, that professionals that do not point that out and send it back up the pipeline are in fact not really living up to their job description. Oh, it's probably safe politically. Oh my God, don't rock the boat. Don't tell them it's wrong. And the reason that I have found this very effective is that most managers, given the situation, want to know. But like all of us, they're not all knowledgeable. And so it may never have dawned on them that there is something here that is not in enlightened self-interest. Because there's one thing you can guarantee right from the start, and that is that trying to persuade people on areas where there is not enlightened self-interest are mostly doomed to failure, if not immediately, soon. Because it isn't just that the audience out there will see through this. It's, remember, there's a hell of a lot of critics and competitors out there that are looking to find holes. And so I think today that part of our responsibility is to make sure that we have the consulting skills, the backbone, to send back up the pipeline our questions about enlightened self-interest, about symmetricality. Because if you look at the model that we talked about yesterday, really, this model of effective organizations works on a three-part principle. The mission is the unique selling proposition, the USP. The culture is what lets us speak with one clear voice. And building relationships depends on enlightened self-interest. So if you want a quick and easy method, the simplest of all for effective public relationships and effective organizations, it's USP, OCV, and ESI. If you can just carry that in your head, you're going to be very close to a methodology that will come in handy when you're faced with a problem or an opportunity. You have to look at it quick. Has it got a unique selling proposition to it? Is there some reason people should pay attention? Is it the kind of a thing that we can realistically expect people within the bank can carry out with one clear voice? Or is it something that we know is doomed to failure because somebody down there hasn't bought into it and is going to make us look silly? And thirdly, is it really, what's in it for them? Is our interest symmetrical with their interest? Now, just to nail that down, I want to ask you a question. Do you know any young lawyers who've just graduated from school? Have you ever come in contact with any of them in the bank or elsewhere? Now, these are young people. They're just out of school. They're really not very experienced. And yet, have you ever noticed how they approach their job. Have you ever heard one of them hesitate to express their opinion or to criticize or to say, hey, that ain't right or it won't work? Even when they're dead wrong, have you ever known any of them to kind of hang back? Do you suppose there's any relationship between that and the hard data brief method that they have of presenting their case and the fact that they are listened to and rise high in the organization? Do you think there's any corollary there? And then look where we are, where maybe we don't give that kind of counseling advice. Maybe we're not knowing the behavioral science to be able to talk with hard data. And maybe there's a correlation here. In fact, I think there is. I think we can learn from those folks that indeed standing up and in a tactful, obviously helpful, I'm on your side kind of a way, pointing out that some of these steps are missing, giving that kind of consulting, and then presenting it in a framework of case studies, of research, of behavioral science theory background, so it's hard data. If you're willing to do those two things, I can practically guarantee you, you're going to find your way to wherever it is you want to go. Because really, there is no alternative. The alternative is just to kind of float and not be masters. I think in public relations today, where organizations depend on relationships, I think it is incumbent upon us as professionals to do that. I don't think we are professionals unless we do that. I hope you'll think about that. Because in an organization your size, in the age of this bank, we know that it's going to be a bureaucracy. It's going to be a post-peak organization, as they say, no longer in its prime. I'm sure your managers love to hear this and think about this. I hope they do think about it, because it's just a reality in the life cycle of organizations. Now think about the opportunity for somebody in some department to spruce that up and say, hey, we're not stuck with this. We can change it. And if you look through the bank, ask yourself who can do that. Essentially, there are two units that can do it and only two. It isn't the marketers and the product designers. Find me a product in a Bank of America that is truly differentiated from a product at Wells Fargo, Citibank, or the bank right downstairs. Find me one. There isn't any product differentiation anymore. What's left? What's left is people, service, where Bank of America started. Who works with that? Public relations and perhaps human resources. So if an organization like Bank of America is indeed not to become a post-peak organization, but to stay at its prime, the fact is we are going to have to do it. We are some enlightened senior managers who understand this philosophy. So I don't see giving consulting, saying where we see things that could be done better, as a problem. I see that as the real opportunity for people in our field. And you know, real proof of that is a fellow who just retired, sort of, from the field. He didn't really retire. His name is Joe Nolan. You may never have heard of Joe, but Joe, for years, was the vice president of public relations at Citibank. And the people who were running Citibank at that time, when it was just starting to creep up on Chase Manhattan in New York, to credit Joe with a lot of that success. He got bored after a number of years doing that, so he went out and got a PhD and went down to the University of South Carolina and established their public relations sequence there, which became one of the best in the country within 2 or 3 years. And he got bored with that after a while, so he went to Monsanto, where he was senior vice president for public relations, and he just retired last year, a guy with a career that hasn't been matched by many in our field. And when he retired, we asked him, Joe, you know, you've been so successful. Tell us the secret. Write us a paper and tell us the secret. He said, I don't have to write a paper. He says, I can give it to you in 4 words, 5 words. Well, okay, let's hear your 5 wonderful words. Joe's 5 words for success in our field are, don't wait to be asked. That's what this man said after 35 years of one of the most successful careers in public relations, and his whole theme was, don't wait to be asked. You are in a position to see the problems and the opportunities. People are ready to accept your counsel if you can prove that you've got the theoretical background for it and the experience, but you just have to get it out there without waiting to be asked. Well, enough said on that subject, but I hope you'll think about it. I handed out a definition last night I hope you had a chance to read it over. The definition postulated that what makes all this work is for us as practitioners to remember that we're not dealing with people's brains and facts and all of those kind of things. We are dealing with perceptions. We're dealing with human nature, with down and dirty human nature. And I would suggest to you that practitioners have to make a decision very early on whether they are going to practice in the real world of human nature with all of its warts and imperfections, but where the world really is, or whether we're going to practice up here in this wonderful dream world of rational people who read all our material and they think about it and they take it to heart. For me, there's only one answer, but I think it is a problem, because we still have a lot of senior managers and a lot of people in the field who are practicing up here in a world that does not exist. It simply does not exist.